You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 209 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Language of the Cosmos, Cosmic Influences and the Spiritual Task of Northern Europe. This is 11 lectures held in Christiania, Oslo, Berlin, Dornach, and Basel from November 24th to December 31st, 1921, and the translation is by Agnes Schneeberg de Stuhr. Lecture 1, given in Christiania, November 24th, 1921, also known now as Oslo. As I am now able to be with you here again, I would like to welcome you in the most cordial and inwardly heartfelt way. You will understand that my words of welcome are even more tinged with special feelings because of the fact that, unfortunately, we were not able to be together for such a long time. I believe, however, that our hearts, as they found each other in looking up to the spiritual worlds, felt nonetheless quite connected in these especially difficult times, even though we were physically separated from each other. And it is out of this common bond that I speak these words of welcome. It has indeed been a very difficult time we have experienced, a time of undergoing severe tests, and only if it is widely recognized as a time of trial and testing will it be possible for something propitious to emerge from it. I, too, am reminded today of the lectures I was able to give in this city many years ago before the war, and those of you who reflect more deeply on what was said on that occasion will come to realize that certain definite indications were interspersed in these lectures that hinted at the terrible times ahead of us at that time. And even today I say quite deliberately that we have not completely overcome these times, that we are still in them. The lectures I gave here dealt with the folk souls of the European peoples, and both as a reminder of them, and in order that you may perhaps realize their purport more clearly, I would like, by way of introduction, to relate a certain interesting episode. In January of 1918, I had a conversation in Central Europe with a personality who, in the autumn of that year, when the war assumed a particularly menacing form, played a brief but significant part in these catastrophic events. As a matter of fact, those who were able to follow the course of events realized already in the beginning of that year that this particular man would be in a key position when matters would come to a critical, decisive point. As mentioned, I had a talk with him in January of that year, and in the course of our conversation he spoke of the need for a psychology, an actual knowledge of the souls of the European peoples. The chaos into which humanity was being thrust would make it essential, so he said, for those who wished to take on a leading role in these affairs, to understand the effects of the forces working in the souls of the different peoples of Europe. And he expressed deep regret that there was really no possibility of basing any decisions regarding such public affairs upon an actual knowledge of the European folk souls. I responded by saying that I had given lectures on this very subject here in Christiania, Oslo, and afterward I sent him this course of lectures, which included a foreword written out of the situation as it was at that time, in January 1918. I am telling you about this episode merely in order to indicate the real purport of these lectures. They were really meant at that time as a guiding orientation in the face of the forces that were leading straight into confusion and chaos. And it was for the same reason that I resorted to them again in the year 1918, in the way indicated. But nothing came of it. It was useless, in spite of the above-mentioned preface written in response to the immediate situation, because the maturity required to develop insight into the magnitude of the forces leading into decadence, although present in a number of human souls, was not present in the souls of those in charge, who were unwilling to strive for such maturity of insight. For today people are still terribly afraid to place before their souls a true picture of the forces that are leading straight into chaos. Instead of facing the reality of these forces of decadence, they prefer to spin all kinds of hazy notions, believing that if they take refuge in them, life will go on quite nicely. Those, however, who refuse to accept such clouded thinking and confront the true reality of the situation hold no such beliefs. It was, in fact, precisely here in Norway that destiny made it necessary to speak of the relationships between the European folk souls. You will remember that I have made a certain remark, expressed in a variety of forms, and either in greater or lesser detail, throughout the years. I have drawn attention to the fact that a time will come in European affairs when much will depend upon whether this northern European region, and Norway in particular, can count among its people those who will, in the fullest sense of the word, sympathize with the side of true progress and devote their powers to furthering this progress. Inasmuch as the geographical position of northern Europe renders this imperative and indeed possible. Here in the north, because there is a certain detachment from European conditions, many things can develop and ripen. But what is ripening here must, gradually, develop into fruit, above all things into the fruit of a truly vibrant spiritual life. This is, after all, the reason for the name given to this anthroposophical branch, which was discussed a number of years ago as well. You yourselves will have had many things pass before your spiritual eye, EYE, during the years that have passed since we last saw each other, during the years of the great European catastrophe, World War I. But it is something else altogether to be in the very midst of it. Only those who actually lived through it, or at any rate through periods of it, were able to feel and realize its full significance. It is difficult to find a word in our human language that can adequately characterize the awfulness of this catastrophe. One is tempted to use the word senseless, because it is indeed the case that nearly everything generated in the domain of European public affairs up to the beginning of the 20th century resulted in some form of senselessness. What went on between the years 1914 and 1918 was a kind of senselessness, and matters have not greatly improved since then. The only difference is that these senseless actions of the materialistic world are not as outwardly noticeable as they were during the actual war years. Today it ought to be recognized, more fully than it generally is, that Europe is bound to come to grief if people do not consider the spiritual foundations of human life, if simply for the sake of convenience they continue to brush aside everything that actually intends to offer help by leading humanity out of this anti-spiritual turmoil. The fact that my lectures on the folk psychology of Northern Europe were ignored by a person who was in a leading position during this period of senseless actions seemed to me to be deeply symptomatic. And it is still basically the case today that everything is brushed aside by those holding leading positions in public life. It would be important if people in Europe understood that certain words spoken casually by a South African statesman are actually words of great significance for European public affairs. These words were not spoken from any great depth, but more from a feeling for the way in which humanity's affairs are developing at the present time. This statesman said that the focal point of the world historical perspective has shifted from the North Sea, that is to say from Europe in general, to the Pacific Ocean. One could also say that the reason for Europe's having held a kind of central position up to now no longer exists, that today we are living within its remains, that it has been superseded by the great global affairs transpiring between the East and the West. What is going on today in clueless fashion in Washington is nothing but a feeble stammering taking place on the surface. but actually surging up from those depths where, mostly still unnoticed, the important affairs of humanity are occurring. There will be no calm on the earth until a certain harmonization will have come to pass between the affairs of East and West. However, people do not yet realize today that this harmony must first be brought about in the realm of the spirit. No matter how much is discussed regarding questions of disarmament and other luxurious matters in the face of these difficult times, these will amount to no more than luxuries, beautiful words, as long as the Western world fails to discover the spirituality that is actually contained but not sought in our culture as it has been developing since the middle of the 15th century. For this culture does indeed contain a store of such treasures. Humanity has acquired a magnificent scientific knowledge of the natural world and has achieved marvelous achievements in technology. We are surrounded by it. All this is truly splendid, but dead. Dead as compared to the great currents of humanity's evolution. And yet in this very death there is a sparkle of life, a living spirituality that can shine into the world even more brilliantly than anything brought to humanity through Oriental wisdom, which, however, must never be belittled in its own right. This is the kind of feeling that I would like to describe to you, the feeling that is present in an unbiased observer. One can turn to the great wisdom treasures of the East, which are contained, albeit merely as a reflection, in the Vedas and in the wonderful Vedanta philosophy and so on. One can be filled with enthusiasm for everything that was revealed in them, as though from heavenly heights to humanity. It has undoubtedly experienced a certain deterioration since then, but even in that form, in which it still lives in the East, it arouses the wonder and admiration of anyone who has a feeling for such things. In contrast, there is the purely materialistic culture of the West, of Europe and America. Yet this purely materialistic culture and its equally materialistic mode of thinking should not be belittled either. At the same time, it must be said that what initially appears to us as materialistic culture does indeed resemble a hard nutshell, a dying nutshell. Nevertheless, it contains the nut, the living kernel. And if this nut can be uncovered, what will then be exposed is something that will outshine all the radiance of the Oriental wisdom that once came down to humanity. But let us not misunderstand the reality of the present situation. As long as the dealings of Europeans and Americans with Asia are confined to purely economic and industrial interests, there will be no trust among the peoples of Asia, no matter how many discussions take place about disarmament, about the desirability of ending wars, and so on. A great war between the East and the West is inevitable, in spite of all disarmament conferences, if a particular thing does not occur. If the people of Asia cannot perceive something coming from the West, something that is in fact the spirit of the West, this spirituality of the West can shine for the people of Asia, and if it does, they will be able to trust it, because with their own inherent, albeit somewhat depleted, spirituality, they will be able to understand it. The peace of the world depends upon this understanding, not upon the international discussions now going on among the world's leaders. Today everything depends on the awareness that the spirit which lies hidden in European and American culture is the important thing, the spirit from which people flee, which they would prefer to avoid for the sake of ease, but which alone can guide humanity to forces of ascent. But people like to build up foggy notions by preferring to repeat again and again that things will improve of themselves. They will not. The hour of a great decision has struck. Either human beings will resolve to elevate the spirituality of which I have spoken, or the decline of the West is inevitable. No hope, no fatalistic longing for things to right themselves will be of any help in this regard. Humanity has, after all, entered a time in which human forces are used in freedom. And it is essential that humanity actually apply these forces out of free will. In other words, it must now decide for itself whether it wants to have this spirituality or not. If the decision is affirmative, then progress will be possible. If it is negative, then the doom of the West is sealed. Then, in the wake of dire catastrophes, the further evolution of humanity will have to take a different course from the one imagined today by many people. If, however, the wish for true insight into these matters is present, then it is imperative that the soul life of human beings in general, and of the various peoples in particular, be studied, particularly the soul life of the peoples of the East and the West. This is the reason for the preliminary remarks made here. They are based on my firm belief that if those qualities to which the Nordic spirit is especially inclined can be cultivated in this particular region of Europe, then it will be possible for insight to ripen, which in turn can also work fruitfully upon the rest of the Western world. Indeed, any spiritual movement can only be taken very seriously when people are inclined to credit it, in the sense here indicated, with a mission that includes this kind of understanding. It is, after all, a fact that our modern civilization regards everything in the universe scientifically, that is, strictly as a matter of mathematics and mechanics. We look at the stars through telescopes, examine their substances by means of the spectroscope, and so on. We then convert what has thus been observed into calculations and formulas, and we finally arrive at the idea of, quote, the universe as a great machine, close quote, into which our Earth is inserted like a cogwheel. We develop fantastic notions about the habitability of other planets, but do not attach great significance to them, because we limit ourselves to mathematical, mechanical formulas to express what is contained in the universe. And humanity has gradually restricted itself to experiencing life on Earth just as a mole, if it had a human soul, might experience itself within its burrow during the winter. In a manner of speaking, the Earth has become like a mole's burrow in the universe. Nowadays, people tend to look back with a certain superciliousness to primitive cultures, in quotes, such as the culture of ancient Egypt, where people did not speak of a great world machine, but rather of divine spiritual beings, who existed outside in space as well as beyond space, beings to whom they knew themselves connected in the same way as they were connected to the beings of the three kingdoms of nature on Earth. The ancient Egyptians had attributed the soul spiritual nature of the human being to the higher hierarchies, to supersensible worlds, in the same way as they attributed the human bodily physical aspect to the kingdoms of nature, to the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms. In our age, if people speak of extra-earthly realms at all, they do so based on a belief system that has grown ever paler and would not stand up to scientific scrutiny. Scientifically, people speak only of a great world machine that can be defined through mathematical formulas and of anything related to human and earthly matters as something that is supposedly confined within the human and cosmic mole burrow, which is ultimately what earthly existence has now become in relation to the cosmos. Yet there is a profound truth, one that can hardly be expressed too poignantly, namely this: when humanity loses the heavens, it loses itself. For it is simply a fact that the most important aspect of human essential nature belongs to the realm that lies beyond the earth, and that if we lose sight of this realm, we lose sight of our own true being. Then we wander across the earth without knowing what kind of beings we really are. And this is basically how human beings today are relating to their earthly existence. We know, but even so only from tradition, that the designation human being applies to us, that this name was originally given to us to indicate a being that stands upright in contrast to the four-legged animals. But our scientific view of the world and our technical culture curb our ability to recognize the true content of the designation human being. For this content ought to be derived from the realm beyond the earth, and this realm, this universe, has been turned into a great world machine. As human beings, we have lost ourselves. We no longer have insight into the true nature of what it means to be a human being. It is definitely a painful but unavoidable experience to realize that the height of the culture to which the West has risen since the middle of the 15th century has actually brought human beings to the point of tearing out their own true nature and wandering the earth essentially as non-human beings divested of their soul spiritual essence. I mentioned yesterday in the lecture I gave for the teachers that we tend to speak rather one-sidedly, and mostly based on tradition, of only one aspect of the eternal nature of human beings. We speak of human eternal nature only insofar as it reaches beyond death, and for that reason we have the word immortality, Unsterblichkeit, literally deathlessness, in modern languages. We do not speak, however, of a human eternal nature reaching beyond birth, of an existence before birth. Nor do we speak of how the human being has descended from divine spiritual worlds into physical, sense-perceptible existence, and of how the human being becomes part of this physical material existence on earth. As a consequence, we do not even have a word that corresponds, at this other pole, to immortality. We speak of immortality, but not of unbornness, Ungeborenheit. And it is only when it will become natural to speak of unbornness, of a pre-birth existence, that it will be possible to understand again the true eternal essential nature of the human being. Why do we even still speak of immortality today? In reality, when the word immortality is used nowadays, it is done in a very different sense from how it was done in times when people still spoke of unbornness. Just listen to the innumerable sermons preached today on the eternal nature of the human soul. And these are sermons that are actually spoken out of a certain subjective honesty. And try to get a clear sense of the prevailing tone contained in them. For they count strongly on the egotism of human beings. They speculate on the fact that we long for immortality, that because of this egotism we abhor the idea of perishing at death. They presume that such egotism is present among the faithful. Just ponder the words spoken along these lines on many occasions, and you will realize that they count on this kind of egotism. When it comes to the question of pre-existence, of life before birth, one cannot reckon with human egotism in the same way. When anything is said about a life before birth today, it does not trigger a response from egotistic human souls, because people will say, albeit not always quite articulately, to themselves, "Why should we take an interest in a life before birth? For even if it exists, we are now living in its continuation. We are in existence now. Why, then, is it necessary to speak of what happened before? We are, after all, absolutely certain that we are here now." Our egotism only lets us entertain the notion that death does not bring annihilation. One must, therefore, when speaking of a life before birth, appeal to selflessness, to the quality of non-egotism. And when speaking of the life after death, which is, of course, quite valid as well, one can indeed do so by appealing to the egotism of the soul. That is the great difference. This also shows clearly that egotism has indeed gripped humanity right down to the deepest layers of the soul. And the outright dismissal of the idea of a pre-existence is a consequence of the egotism in the human soul. It is important that these things, more than any other things, be understood by those who are earnest in their striving for spiritual insight. Human beings must find themselves again as regards their true innermost being. People must become interested again in the whole essential nature of the human being, not merely in the outer physical sheaths. But this can only come about when the human being will once again be regarded as belonging not only to the earth, to the cosmic mole burrow, but rather to the whole cosmos, when it is clearly recognized that between death and a new birth, the human being passes through the world of the stars. And when this world of the stars, to which we can only gaze upward from the earth, will be known once again in its living essence, in its soul essence, and in its spiritual essence. The first thing that appears to us when we observe a human being is his outer physical structure. But we do not generally pay particular attention to its principal feature, namely its form. And yet this form is assuredly the main thing when it comes to the physical human being. Now, when we embark upon a theme like this, which incidentally touches on many things contained in other lecture cycles, it will be obvious at once that initially only brief indications can be given. But from what you have already gained from anthroposophy, both as regards its spiritual content and its way of thinking, you will be able to recognize that what I am about to say now is something that represents not merely a series of fleeting analogies, but rather something that is, in fact, derived from a deeper knowledge of the world. When we observe the human form, we essentially see a marvelous structural organization of the human being. To begin with, we have the human head. It is actually modeled after the cosmos. It bears the form of the cosmos. To begin with, its form is spherical, round. This spherical form is only subject to a certain modification at its base, where it is linked to the other components that make up the physical human being. In other words, this spherical form is modified at its base in order to be joined to those parts that do not constitute the human head. In principle, however, the human head is modeled after the spherical form of the universe, as you can observe for yourself, even already from the basic shape of the human embryo. Linked to this head formation, we have another structure, which, although in a much more hidden and not immediately apparent way, still retains something of the spherical form, namely the chest structure of the human being. In this chest structure, please try to picture this spiritually in your mind, we have something that is like a spherical form squashed and elongated by a variety of other forces, like a sphere having undergone a substantial metamorphosis. And when finally we observe the limb structure, the third component of the human being, we can only just perceive something of the original, embryonic-like, spherical form of the human being. It is only through true spiritual science that we are alerted to the fact that even the limbs still contain certain traces of a spherical form, although this is not very obvious in their outer shape. When we study the threefold human configuration in its relation to the cosmos, we can say that the human being is formed out of forces coming from the cosmos, but that these forces work upon us in many different ways. Think of the different ways in which the human being is subject to the influences of the fixed stars. Throughout the various epochs, people have viewed the changing position of the sun in the zodiacal constellations as an indication of how different forces are working down from the world of the fixed stars. Even today, our mechanistically inclined astronomy speaks of the fact that the sun rises in a particular constellation in spring at the vernal equinox, that in the course of time it will move through other zodiacal signs, that during the day it passes through certain constellations and during the night through others, and so on. But there is no awareness of the relationship that exists between the human being and this whole extra-earthly universe. For example, it is not really known today that when the sun is shining upon the earth, from the constellation of Aries in the spring, that is, when the vernal equinox is in Aries, the effect of the solar forces upon human beings is different in certain parts of the earth, due to the fact that the sun's forces are modified by the influences emanating from the region of the fixed stars that is represented by the constellation of Aries. Nor is it known that these forces are especially suited to working upon the human head in such a way that during their life on earth, human beings can develop a certain faculty of self-observation, self-knowledge, and consciousness of their own eye, capital. There is a special significance to being exposed to the forces coming from Aries. As you know, it was particularly during the Greco-Latin cultural epoch that the sun stood in the constellation of Aries at the vernal equinox, and that it was therefore principally during this time that humanity, especially in Western regions, was subject to the Aries forces. This situation, that is, humanity being exposed to the forces coming from Aries, meant that the human head organization could be developed in such a way that a certain eye consciousness, a certain faculty of self-contemplation, could unfold. Even when the zodiacal signs are discussed today, from an historical point of view, the crux of the matter is not always recognized. Historical traditions point to the signs of the zodiac, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, and so on. Images are shown, but few people know what these things really mean. In old calendars, we frequently find the symbol of Aries, but very few people realize the point of greatest significance, namely, that the ram is depicted in such a way that the head is looking back. What this picture was meant to indicate is that the Aries forces work upon the inner aspect of the human being, as the ram does not look forward, out into the wide world, but rather looks back, that is, toward itself, toward its own being. This reflecting upon itself, depicted in the figure of the ram, is full of significant importance. We must find our way again, and this time in full consciousness, not with the instinctive clairvoyance people had in olden times, to this cosmic wisdom. We must come to know again that the forces of our head organization are predominantly developed through the forces of Aries, Taurus, Gemini, and Cancer, that the forces of our chest structure are formed through the forces of the four constellations in the middle, that is Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio. We must come to know again that our head receives its form from the cosmos through the influence of the forces coming from Aries, Taurus, Gemini, and Cancer, and that if we want to comprehend the human head form, these forces must be thought of as radiating from above downward, whereas the zodiacal forces working upon the human chest structure, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, must be thought of as working laterally. And then, situated beneath the earth, there are the other four constellations, their influences blanketed by the earth, as it were. These four constellations work through the earth, not directly like Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, not laterally like the other four, but rather from below upward. They work in such a way that they cannot sustain the spherical form. These forces work upon the human limbs. The forces of the limb organization are formed by the constellations, which in the instinctive consciousness of olden times were envisaged to be working upon human beings, in such a way that the earth is situated between the human being and these constellations. The human being stands upright on the earth, and so when constellations are beneath the earth, they work upon the human limbs. And in these olden times there was still an awareness that the forces which give the limbs their earthly shape have a connection to these particular constellations, that the form of the limbs has its origin in these constellations. The spherical formation of the head, therefore, was known to be connected with Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer. And it was known that the forces affecting the limbs also worked in a fourfold way: Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces. As this knowledge stemmed from ancient clairvoyance, the terminology used to describe these things also stems from the conditions prevailing at that time. Thus, in those olden times when knowledge was derived from the stars, one person might have been a hunter, an archer. In that case, the constellation that was thought to stimulate the corresponding activity in his limbs, which made him into a hunter, received the name of Sagittarius, the archer. Or someone might have been a shepherd, concerned with the care of animals. In that case, the corresponding activity was associated with the goat, with the constellation that is called Capricorn today, although it is not really a goat, as its symbol contains a fish tail. This illustrated the general distinction between the animal caretaker, Capricorn, and the hunter, Sagittarius. The third constellation in this group was Aquarius, the water carrier. But if you take a good look at the ancient symbol of this water carrier, then it becomes clear that it does not show a water person, in the sense of someone splattering about in water. The true image of this constellation is of a human being walking as though on firm soil, on a meadow or a field, fertilizing it, or watering it from a water vessel. It depicts a human being engaged in agriculture, as it is represented by the farmer. This was the third occupation of these ancient times, when there was still an instinctive knowledge about these things, the occupations of hunter, shepherd, farmer. The fourth occupation was that of the mariner, the sailor. In very early times, ships were built in the form of a fish, and even in later times, one can still often see a dolphin's head at the prow of vessels. This is where the symbol of Pisces comes from. In depicting two ships, in the form of two intertwined fish, trading together, it represents the fourth occupation connected to the forces working in the human limbs, namely the occupation of the merchant or trader. This is how the human form was derived from the cosmos. The archetypal form of the head is the spherical form. Here the human being is directly exposed to the forces of the fixed stars, or respectively to the corresponding representatives among the zodiacal constellations. Then, working laterally upon the chest organization, where the spherical form is only present in an eclipsed and hidden way, are the forces of Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio. And then there are the forces that do not work directly upon the human formation, but rather in a roundabout way, through their influence upon earthly activities, through their affecting the corresponding occupations. Incidentally, the divine cosmic entity connected to the hunter, Sagittarius, was sometimes depicted as a kind of centaur, half horse, half human being. In other words, half animal, half human being, and so on. From this you can see, and in our present time we must again develop such insights in full consciousness, how the human being was placed within the cosmos. The form and shape of the human physical body were acknowledged to be the result of cosmic influences. The upper part of the human body was viewed as a product of the cosmos, the lower part as a product of the earth. The earth blanketed those constellations known to affect earthly activities. And we will only be able to comprehend the mysteries of the human form and its relation to human activities on earth when we recognize and acknowledge the inherent relation between the human being and the entire cosmos. And to begin with, this human form indeed leads us to the zodiacal constellations. Just as it is important for life here on earth that someone is, for example, a farmer, and in this context only the ancient occupations are represented, but in the following lectures we shall hear how these things apply in our own time. So, in the same way, it is important that we come to realize again that as far as earthly life between birth and death is concerned, the human being belongs to the powers of the earth, that with respect to life between death and a new birth, he belongs to the heavenly powers, and that these powers initially shape the human head out of themselves, and then leave it to the forces of the earth to give form to the human limbs. This is how the human form can be studied. Similarly, we can also study the human life forms or life levels. To begin with, when we observe this life of the human being, we find there the same two poles. On the one side, we have the life in respect to the head, and on the other side, the life that comes to expression in human activities, particularly through the limbs. In between these two poles lies the aspect of the human being that manifests and makes itself known in the rhythms of breathing and of the circulation of the blood. But at these two poles of the human being, we have at the one end the head organism, and at the other end the limb organism. The head organism constitutes, for the most part, the dying aspect of the human being. For in reality, the head is perpetually dying. Our life is only possible because throughout the whole of our earthly life, forces are continually sent upward to the head from the metabolic limb organism. If the head were to unfold merely its own inherent forces, it would only unfold death forces and would be in a state of dying. However, the fact that we can think, that we have a consciousness, is entirely due to this dying process. At the very moment when an excess of pure life forces flows to the head, consciousness ceases. For all intents and purposes, life means a dimming of consciousness, whereas death, introduced into life, means a lighting up of consciousness. If, for example, only a tiny amount of what is rightly located in the stomach were to find its way to the head would become like the stomach, that is to say, without consciousness. We owe the head's consciousness solely to the circumstance that our head is not permeated with life in the same way as the stomach. A dimming of consciousness means that the forces of nutrition and growth are protruding too strongly into the head. On the one side, we are dying beings. On the other, we are beings who are continually coming to birth. The dying part, which is precisely the part that constitutes our consciousness, thrives primarily when it is exposed to the forces working down upon the earth from the spheres of the outer planets, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars. For naturally, the forces that integrate the human being into the universe are not only related to the fixed stars, but also to the planetary spheres. Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, the so-called outer planets, contain the forces that work chiefly in the direction of the consciousness pole in the human being. The forces coming from the so-called inner planets, Venus, Mercury, Moon, work in the direction of the metabolic limb system. The sun itself stands in the middle and is mainly associated with the rhythmic system. Together, these represent the seven conditions of our life, the seven levels of life. On the one hand, through the life levels that represent an eradication, a suppression of life, so that consciousness can come about, we are, with respect to our earthly life, more akin to heaven, akin to the more distant planetary realms. On the other hand, through the life levels that represent the actual unbridled life, that is, the forces of metabolism and of the movements of the limbs, we are akin to the inner planets, to Mercury, Venus, Moon. The Moon is, after all, directly connected with what is the most rampant life in the human being, namely the forces of reproduction. Accordingly, when we study the life of the human being, we are led to the realm of the planets. And when we study the human form, we are led to the realm of the fixed stars, respectively to their corresponding representatives in this realm, the zodiacal constellations. When we study life, whether it be a more rampant or a more dying life, we are led to the planetary spheres. And in the same way, we can study the soul nature and the spirit nature of the human being. This shall be done in the following lectures. Today, I only wanted to indicate, through this very brief exposition about the significance of the cosmos for the human being, that we must learn again to regard ourselves, not merely as earthly beings, not to see our human form and life only in relation to what we encounter here on earth as the forces of wind and weather, of autumn and spring, or as the forces of heredity, digestion, and so on. Rather, that we must learn again to relate both our life and our form to what is known to exist in the cosmos. We must find again what lies beyond the earthly realm. Then we will find our true being, ourself. It would signify the greatest misfortune for the progress of Western humanity if the notion of the, quote, machine-like cosmos, close quote, the product of the scientific worldview that began to develop since the middle of the 15th century, were to remain, and human beings were to wander on the earth knowing nothing of their true being. Because of the fact that our true being belongs to realms beyond the earth, we cannot really know anything about ourselves, as long as we see only what is earthly, and regard what lies in realms beyond the earth only in terms of mathematics and mechanics, as modern science does. As earthly human beings, we can only find our true self when we are able to link ourselves again to what lies beyond the earth. It is essential that this realm be incorporated into our moral and social life, if it is to thrive. It is for this reason that in reality no moral social wisdom can arise unless a link is forged to cosmic wisdom. This is why it is necessary, and again, more will be said about this in the following lectures, that some of the things inferred by the science of the spirit, anthroposophy, be presented with respect to the moral social domain as well, for these impulses can lead from forces of decline to forces of ascent. The end of Lecture 1.